the dark kitchen. She sat there for so long and so still that when the phone rang, she jumped to her feet. Even at its lowest volume, it startled her, and she rushed across the kitchen to pick up. The voice on the other end was a man's, a younger man's. She was relieved it was no one she knew. He sounded British, but with a lilt or swerve in the accent that she couldn't place. He asked if she was Lydia Morey, and when she said yes, he said, "Miss Lydia Morey, you've won the lottery." Silly, she knew. Obviously some kind of scam. But she was caught off guard. "I don't win anything," she said without thinking. Then told him he must have the wrong person because she hadn't entered any lottery. As if anticipating her response, he said, "Sometimes we enter lotteries and do not know. For example, if you have a magazine subscription or a AAA membership, you may have automatically been submitted for a lottery." She told him she didn't have any magazine subscriptions and was not a member of anything. And then he laughed. A big, wide, warm laugh. After that, he just said her name slowly. "Miss Lydia Morey." He just said her name, the same one when spoken out loud at the coffee shop earlier had caused her to flee. As he said it, heat rippled across her chest. A funny bone she didn't even know was still there had been tickled, and something like a smile wrinkled her lips. Before she let him speak another word, she slammed the phone in its cradle. June. There is no lake. She has been inching along this rock-strewn dirt road for hours, and there has been no sign of water, no cars, no humans, no evidence that she took the right exit after Missoula, or pointed the car in the right direction each time the almost road forked. She is lost and alone, and it does not matter. Nothing does, she thinks, not for the first time. She circles the idea again and again, that no choice she might make would have any impact on her or anyone else. Before now, she would have felt exhilarated by the idea of existing without obligation or consequence. But the experience is nothing like she once imagined. This is a half-life, a split purgatory where her body and mind coexist but occupy separate realities. Her eyes look at what is ahead, the road, a fallen tree, but her mind scours the past, judges each choice made, relives every failure, roots out what she overlooked, took for granted, and didn't pay attention to. The present scarcely registers. The people she sees are not the ones pumping gas into the Subaru, passing her on the highway, or making change when they sell her bottles of water and peanuts at mini-marts and gas stations. Instead, it is Luke, pleading with her in a kitchen that no longer exists. Lolly, shouting at the top of her 14-year-old lungs from across a restaurant table in Tribeca. Adam, looking up at her, shocked, a young girl's hand in his. Lydia stepping toward her that morning, before she knew what had happened, and the confusion and hurt on her face as June waved her off. She returns to these memories and replays them over and over, scrutinizes every remembered word, witnesses again each mistake. When she exhausts one, another appears. Another always does. Her mind leaps to her childhood friend Annette. Annette lived two streets away in the same neighborhood in Lake Forest, and they spent their Saturday nights at each other's house, playing with Annette's collection of porcelain horses, listening to Sean Cassidy and Jackson 5 records, making lists of where they would live when they grew up, what car they would drive, and what their husbands would look like. She remembers convincing Annette to come with her to sleepaway camp in New Hampshire the summer between 5th and 6th grades. Annette was timid, a careful creature who was reluctant to agree. For both, it would be their first time away from home without parents, and Annette cited plenty of reasons not to go. The high school boys who lifeguarded at the club pool, an Arabian horse show coming to Chicago. But June kept at her over the Christmas holiday, even convinced her mother to call and explain to Annette's protective mother the place where she herself had gone as a girl. June can't recall why it was so important she come with her, but remembers clearly the triptych of cousins from Beverly Hills, who naturally and without ceremony establish themselves at the top of the social pecking order from the first day. They had glamorous names, Kyle, Blair, and Marin, and all three had the same feathered shoulder-length light brown hair. On the second full day at camp, the Beverleys, as they had come to be known, asked June to switch her bunk with a chunky, gravel-voiced girl named Beth from Philadelphia. Beth and the Beverleys had been assigned the same cabin four down from June and Annette's. And Beth, the cousins explained, not only smelled like garlic, but stared at them when they were changing. June's face prickles with heat as she remembers sneaking her sleeping bag and duffel to her new cabin while Annette ate lunch with the others in the lodge. Later that night, one of the counselors showed up at June's cabin with Annette, who insisted on speaking to June. She hadn't believed Beth when she explained that June had asked her to switch bunks. June remembers Annette's face relaxing as she entered the cabin. She imagines what must have raced through her head in that moment. Here was June, her best friend, the girl she traveled halfway across the country with, who knew everything there was to know about her, and who was wearing the rope bracelet Annette made for her birthday 2 years ago. Here was June, and she would clear everything up. June remembers how she attempted to be casual, to pretend that nothing important had transpired or changed. But as she stumbled through a rehearsed explanation that it seemed like a good idea to give each other space and meet new people, Annette's face froze. She looked at June as if she were regarding a complete stranger. It was not anger or hurt that registered on her pale, blank face. It was horror. June had, in that instant, transformed into someone she didn't know. June can see Annette shaking her head as if she had been hit from behind by a thrown rock. She can see her turn toward the cabin door and walk away as the Beverleys snickered from their bunks. Annette went home the next morning. They were 12 years old, and the two girls never spoke again. That fall, when they returned to Lake Forest Country Day for the first day of sixth grade, Annette would not look at her. June wonders what became of Annette's vast collection of porcelain horses. She took fastidious care of each one, dusting and polishing their glazed coats, gently brushing their manes and tails. There were dozens, maybe hundreds. Annette was an only child and had a playroom lined with white bookshelves loaded with those horses. She and her mother made special trips to antique dealers in Springfield and Bloomington and Chicago to expand her collection. She had a real horse, too, a dark brown gelding quarter horse she named Tilly, who was kept at a stable in Winnetka. But June was never invited there after school or on weekend mornings when Annette rode. June cannot remember the father clearly, only that he smoked a pipe, always wore a tie, and was rarely there. After eighth grade, Annette and Tilly went east to a horsey boarding school in Virginia, and June lost track of her. More than two decades later, after her divorce from Adam, and after she'd moved to London, June was having lunch with a client, the American wife of a British banker, and when June's childhood in Lake Forest came up, the woman asked her if she remembered a girl named Annette Porter. She'd been a sorority sister of hers at Butler University in Indiana. "Great girl," the woman said, and though it stung to hear Annette's name even all those years later, it was a relief to know that she had been welcomed into a sisterhood somewhere, and in that circle was considered great. It never occurred to June before now what might have happened to Annette's mother when her daughter left home. She imagines the poor woman taking up Annette's duties, dusting, polishing, and brushing the manes of each figurine. June pictures her now, all these years later, muttering to them, bringing them up to speed on the little neighborhood trader who used to visit, the one who lured Annette to sleepaway camp, and how she finally got what was coming to her. Streaks of blue flash between the pines, and for a moment June struggles to remember where she is. She traces an imaginary map as she slows the car to a stop. Montana, Glacier National Park, Bowman Lake. She turns the engine off and watches the lake appear between the space and the trees. It reminds her of when Lolly would see a jumping light through the windows of the house in Connecticut at night and be convinced it was a UFO. She wouldn't rest until they'd gone outside to see, and of course it was always just a star above the trees, beyond the house, blinking in and out of view. Still, she would insist that she'd seen something extraordinary. June gets out of the car and looks for a path. The pine forest is dense, and though it is early afternoon and midsummer, the air is chilly under the branches. She fetches her coat from the car and wraps it around her shoulders before stepping off the road. Pine needles crunch softly beneath her tennis shoes, and birds holler as she makes her way toward a clearing that overlooks a narrow strip of rocky beach. From there she can see the entire lake, which is much longer than it is wide, and swerves gently to the left as it stretches toward its end. Impossibly straight pines cover the low hills that swell from the waterline, and beyond them rise hulking stone mountains. The landscape reminds her of northern Scotland, though these hills are younger, she decides, less worn out. The sun dazzles the wind-chopped surface of the water, and the effect is blinding. There is, briefly, nothing but light. She squints from reflex, but the rest of her surrenders, waits to be erased. It is a quick oblivion, snuffed out as swiftly as it arrives. A cloud barges across the sky and returns color and shape to the trees, the hills, the pebbled shore. She waits for the sun to flare again, and soon it does. She feels its heat, enormous, perfect, and shivers as it recedes. She stands and waits for the radiant nothing to return, and as she does, remembers a motel shower 4 or 5 days ago in Gary, Indiana, with water pressure so forceful she saw stars as she let it pummel the back of her neck and head. She stood there until the water went cold. She thinks of the morning in her car days ago, just over the North Dakota state line, when she woke to the sound of idling school buses and shouting. Stiff from sleeping in the front seat and only half awake, she blinked toward children in t-shirts and shorts dragging backpacks and lunchboxes. She had no idea where or who she was or what she was seeing. She looked at the light brick building, the buses, the American flag dangling from a white pole. Nothing was familiar. She was empty of memory, and instead of being frightened or upset, she was, dimly, without yet understanding why, relieved. The spell broke when she noticed her linen jacket bunched between the driver's seat and the car door. It took nothing more than the sight of the wrinkled fabric for every last memory to return, including pulling off the interstate late the night before, looking for a motel and instead finding a quiet spot in the parking lot next to the school. More clouds gather and the surface of the water darkens. She can now see more clearly the long, rectangular shape of the lake. It is just as Lolly described to her in a postcard once. Flawless. That was the word she used. She had found a flawless place, the first on her journey across country after her freshman year in college. Perhaps the first ever. She'd been gone for more than a month when the postcard arrived, the first and the last she would send June from the trip. It was just one of 4 missives Lolly had ever mailed to her, and the only one June saved. The postcard had been in the house, tucked away in one of her address books, but June remembers clearly the image of the lake. The Kalispell, Montana postmark, the stiff closing, the clipped, telegram-like sentences wedged between the postcard's edge and her London mailing address. M. A flawless place. The first so far. Back in New York early August. Until soon. L. The photo on the postcard had shown snow on the surrounding mountaintops. But now, under the summer sun, they are bare rock. This difference aside, the lake looks the same. Nothing changes here, June thinks, but then remembers an article she'd skimmed years ago about global warming and the gradual disappearance of the glaciers from Glacier National Park. Looking at this lake and these mountains, she wonders when the glacier that made this place was last in residence, how long it lasted. Did some trace of it still remain when Lolly was here? Lolly was 18 years old when she looked at this lake. 18, and angry, and newly free. She had lived with her father in New York the last 3 years of high school. Her choice to stay with him after the divorce was never questioned or challenged, though it took the wind out of June when Adam, not Lolly, told her. It never occurred to her that Lolly would stay in New York. But when June spoke to her the next day, Lolly made it clear that just as June had made her decision to leave them for London, she had in turn made hers. They spent Christmas together at the house in Connecticut the first year after the divorce, but it ended abruptly with Adam driving back to the city on Christmas Day after Lolly opened her presents. There had been no fight, no dramatic blow-up, just Adam's restlessness and Lolly's hostile quiet. She begged her father to take her back to the city, but he insisted she stay since June would be in the States for only 2 weeks and they should spend time together. Lolly retreated to her room upstairs, and she and June spent the remaining days silent and on separate floors. Lolly refused to eat with June, and would instead take bowls of granola and cup after cup of coffee upstairs. June stayed in London the following Christmas, and in the years when Lolly was at Vassar, June and Adam worked out alternating Christmas Eve and Christmas Day custody. Lolly never came to London. In 5 years, she never saw the gallery June opened, never saw the small carriage house in Islington where she lived, never accepted any of June's invitations to join her in London and travel on to Europe or Scotland or Ireland. She returned one out of every 7 or 8 phone calls, just enough to keep from creating a crisis and instigating a serious discussion. She hardly ever wrote emails before texting came along, and even then the missives either explained her silence or signaled more. "We'll call this weekend. Buried. Can't make it to New York next week when you're there. Sorry." There were a lot of sorries. The sun returns. The lake shines again. The birds have stopped yelling, and June hears Lolly's voice rise above the noises of a restaurant the night she and Adam explained what was going to happen. June had just finished calmly describing how she and Adam were getting divorced, would remain friends, and that she would be opening a gallery in London for her boss. Lolly, June explained, could come with her or stay in New York to finish high school.
"Liar!"
Lolly shouted from across the table of the restaurant on Church Street, where they ate most Sunday nights after returning from Connecticut. The whole place went silent.
"You lied to us. You did. You lied. You promised to be a mother and a wife, and now you're choosing to be neither."
Lolly glared in silence before running to the bathroom. June can see her, the table between them, Adam at her side, mute, Lolly's eyes tearless, desperately scanning her mother's face for something familiar, anything she could recognize. June knows these eyes. They are Annette's, Luke's, Lydia's, people who when they last looked at her saw a stranger. June never argued custody with Adam. She never told Lolly how Adam had been accused of sexual harassment at NYU, how they had to settle and by doing so wiped out their savings and nearly half of the inheritance her father had left her when she was in her 20s. The only thing June hung on to was the house in Connecticut, which she and Adam had paid off only the year before. It was the unexpected financial setback, June told herself then, that kept her pushing for bigger and bigger sales at the gallery, landing more lucrative artists and needing to fly around the globe for both. But she knows now she couldn't face what was happening at home, what was going on with Adam. She knew a fire was behind the smoke of accusation, even though she wanted to believe him when he insisted the student who'd filed suit was unstable. Lolly had been a kid at the time, and June chose to believe Adam. For that belief to sustain, Lolly could never find out, which she never did, or if she had, she never let on. June wonders if all the secret-keeping back then explained why, years later, she covered up for Adam again. Had it become second nature? Lolly also never knew about the call June received from her friend Peg, who was, she whispered, at that moment watching Adam hold hands with a young girl at a restaurant in Long Island City. "Stay out of sight," June told Peg before scribbling down the address and beelining out of the gallery onto 57th Street to hail a cab. The restaurant was on the roof of an old loft building on Jackson Avenue near PS1. As June entered the freight elevator, she tried to imagine how Adam had found his way here, how he must have thought it was another planet, this stomping ground for young hipsters and musicians, a frontier for the creative and the broke, but most important, a place where no one knew him and where he'd never get caught. June spotted Adam right away and was relieved that Peg hadn't made a mistake. The relief was, at last, the absence of the doubt she'd had for years, even before the lawsuit. The relief was that he would now get caught in a manner that left no room for explanation or double talk. Before approaching the table, June saw the month ahead. A divorce with terms she would dictate, accepting the long-on-the-table offer from her boss Patrick to open a gallery in London that she hadn't until now allowed herself to take seriously. She watched Adam stare at the girl while she tapped on her Palm Pilot with her free hand, and for the first time June could see him in his natural state, not the one he fashioned to keep family harmony. He looked old, surrounded here by flannels and tattoos and full beards, hunched over this distracted girl who was only a few years older than their daughter. This was her husband, the man she'd once loved and wished to build a life with, the man she still loved, despite years of resenting him. This, she recognized, was her freedom. She could see it all as she stepped toward the small table along the wall. The girl with the wide face and black hair. Adam's fingers on the inside of her wrist. The table covered in cornbread. She could see the future that day, but she failed to see Lolly. Failed to think through the next steps carefully. Failed to resist Adam's desperate plea not to tell their daughter about the affair, and failed to see how not telling her the truth would shape everything between them after. She moved too fast toward that table, and she moved too fast after. To court, to agree with Adam, to London. She knows that if she could retrace her steps after that phone call from Peg, rethink every decision that followed, she would not be standing on the shore of a lake in the middle of nowhere. And everyone would be alive. June takes a few steps back from the lake and leans against the closest pine. Near its trunk, patches of thick green moss cover the ground like tossed pillows. She tries to imagine Lolly in this place 5 years ago. Did she stand right here? Did she stop at the first sight of water, too, and find her way to this clearing? Did she rest on this moss? Did she look to the lake and see her mother as she now sees Lolly? Is this where she began to forgive her? And if she were alive, could she possibly forgive her now? June sits down on the damp moss and draws her knees to her chest. There is no peace for her here. She remembers the morning in North Dakota 2 days before when she decided to find this place. Bowman Lake. These two words came to her as she watched what must have been summer school students filing noisily across the parking lot into the school. Bowman Lake, Glacier National Park, Montana. She saw again the small black capital letters at the bottom of the postcard spelling the location. And as the school buses shut their doors and lumbered toward the road, she could see the pristine lake, its glassy surface reflecting a cloudless sky. She remembered Lolly's careful handwriting on the other side. And as she read the short sentences over and over, she understood where she needed to be. A place where her daughter had found no flaw. Rebecca. Her car just sits there, a newish Subaru wagon with New York plates. Black, like all the cars I remember there. I guess we could call in the license plate number if we really wanted to know who she is, but it feels too sneaky, and on some level I think each of us, me, Kelly, Sissy, feels as if she has, even though she barely speaks, appointed us her protectors. From what or from whom, I don't know, but from something. So tracing her plates, however one does that, I have no idea. Or sleuthing around in any way feels like breaking the deal we struck when we agreed to let her stay here anonymously. If we'd had a problem then, we could have refused her. But we chose not to, and so she stays here, whoever she is. At Christmas, one of Kelly's brothers came down from Seattle with his wife and sons, and we opened presents Christmas morning and cooked a big dinner that afternoon. Kelly left a note under the door to room 6, inviting her to join our 4 o'clock supper, but she never responded or came, not that we expected her to. Sissy left a tin of her sugar cookies topped with chocolate and caramel, in addition to what looked like a loaf of the same banana and blueberry bread she made for us. At least she's getting some fruit, Kelly joked, but for the first time looking genuinely worried. I've been worried since the day she arrived. Something about the way she dragged herself when she walked, her exhaustion, and the limit to how much she could engage, the way her eyes were open physically, but in every other way were shut. It was a look I recognized.
"What if she's come to die here? What then?"
I asked Kelly after the new year. "Then she's come here to die, and there's nothing we can or should do about it," she answered, matter-of-fact, as usual. "But if she dies, and it comes out that we checked her in without ID or credit card, won't we get in trouble? Isn't there some law?" Kelly looked at me in the way that she does, that way that makes me feel like a ridiculous child who's asked to stay up an hour past her bedtime. She looked at me this way when I first brought up leaving Seattle and moving here. And she kept on looking at me this way until she finally came around. One thing about Kelly is that although she's deeply set in her ways, up at 6:15 every morning, black coffee and a boiled egg with the newspaper down the hatch by 7, Levi's cords and L.L. Bean flannel shirts and nothing but nothing else, she is also brave. If she has a good enough reason to set a new course, she will. And in this case, the good enough reason was me. I wanted to leave Seattle because of my friend Penny. She was my closest friend, and I'd known her since I was a little kid. We grew up a few doors down from each other in Worcester, Massachusetts, in big Catholic families, and went to the University of Massachusetts together after high school. We never had a fling because neither of us could back then admit to ourselves or each other that we were gay. Not in high school, not in college, and not for a while after. You have to remember this was the 70s and early 80s. And though it's not that long ago, for gays it's like another millennium. Especially in Worcester, Massachusetts, and especially in our neighborhood, which was 100% Catholic and 100% straight, at least on the surface. After Penny and I graduated from college, we went to New York. She wanted to work in advertising, and neither of us could face returning to Worcester. I had always planned on Boston, but Penny could be pushy when she wanted to be, and so New York it was. We lived on the Upper East Side at first, and in many ways, not good ones, it felt like places we'd been. Mostly families, straight couples, and hard-partying college graduates living 5 to an apartment. It took us a while, but we found our way to other parts of the city, and eventually to other women like us. But boy, were we slow. Or at least I was. Once she found it, Penny took to that scene quick, and within a few months had a girlfriend, a job as a bartender at Henrietta Hudson, and was on a softball team. I didn't like those bars so much, the hard drinking and the drugs. Those girls were wild. Most of them, like us, were from somewhere else and had whole lifetimes of loneliness and anger stored up. Once they hit the city and each other, they let it all out, and often it was messy. Penny started to get messy, and after she moved in with her girlfriend, a young girl named Chloe, we drifted apart. I was working at the Lowell Hotel on East 63rd at the time as a check-in clerk. It's a beautiful Art Deco gem, and many of the rooms are actually apartments where people live either year-round or when they're in town for shopping or shows or business. I loved the order of the place, the fresh flowers, the crisp staff uniforms, the history. It felt like nothing bad could ever happen there. I got promoted twice in that first year, and by the time I was 26, I was an assistant manager. Nothing had ever really worked so well for me. Not childhood, school, family, or the gay scene in New York. In all these places, I had always been the odd duck. But at the Lowell, I fit. I knew where I was useful and where I wasn't. And so I spent most of my time there, on and off the clock. Meanwhile, Penny was bartending and boozing and giving up on her dream of working in advertising. She'd gone on some interviews and sent her resume around when we first got to New York, but once she moved in with Chloe, all that stopped. Chloe had been raised in Brooklyn by 2 hippie parents and was out and proud since high school. She was 19 and had already dropped out of Barnard College by the time she met Penny. It wasn't until Penny's first overdose on heroin that I began to understand what was going on. Even though it had been over a month since we'd seen each other, I was still her emergency contact at the bar. So 2 days after she hadn't showed up, I got a call. I tracked down Chloe, who tried at first to cover it up. She floundered with the story that Penny was home with the flu,
but only after I showed up at their apartment on the Lower East Side and pounded on the door did she finally tell me the truth. Penny was on the psych ward at Bellevue, where she had been transferred after detoxing in the emergency room. The hospital wouldn't release her for at least a few more days. Chloe told me later that night that she wanted Penny to move out, that she was a disaster, and that the whole scene was too much for her to handle. Never mind that it was Chloe who'd introduced Penny to heroin. We packed Penny's things and moved them into my studio in Murray Hill. Chloe gave me a letter to give to Penny, breaking things off, I assume, since I never read it. Whatever she wrote convinced Penny not to try to change Chloe's mind. Penny lived with me the rest of that year. There'd be two more overdoses, hundreds of dollars stolen from my wallet, and a suicide attempt before Penny finally agreed to go to a rehab I found outside Seattle. I flew with her there and stayed the first few days, but then returned to New York to my job. She stayed in that rehab for 8 months, and then moved for a year and a half into a nearby sober house with other women in recovery. By then, I'd been out to Seattle to visit her a dozen times. Penny's family, like mine with me, wanted nothing to do with her when she came out to them, which was the Christmas after our first year in New York. It's not an original story, except that we decided to tell our parents the same night. We timed it to dinner, which was 6 o'clock in both our houses. In my case, my father left the table and my mother wept into her napkin. In her case, they asked her to leave the house and come back only when she had, her father said, cleaned up her act. She knocked on my door that night, slept in a sleeping bag on my bedroom floor, and we went back to New York together first thing in the morning. My mother eventually came around, but only after my father had died. And even then she asked that I not rub it in her face by telling her about girlfriends. Meeting them, and of course there only ever was one, was out of the question. So she died doing the best she could, but in the end we barely knew each other. After that Christmas, Penny and I were, for each other, clearly the only people we could count on. Besides my job at the Lowell and the people I worked with there, Penny was my entire world. Every free weekend or vacation I had was on a plane to Seattle to see her. On one of those trips I met Kelly. She was the manager at the Holiday Inn, not far from Penny's sober house. And one night after I'd flown all day from New York, she checked me in. She was agitated, I could tell, but professional. I found out later she was working the check-in desk because one of her employees had called in sick at the last minute, and as a result she had to miss her nephew's basketball game. There she was, in her gray cords and green Holiday Inn blazer, wrinkling her nose like she always does when she's pissy. I remember watching her for a long time, her head down, red hair jammed into a ponytail with loose strands floating from her head like spun gold, processing my credit card and mumbling under her breath all the while. Finally, she looked up, and for the first time I saw her eyes, green and gold and flashing like Christmas trees from her freckle-splattered face. I don't know how someone like me, who had never before even had a girlfriend, could recognize love when it arrived, but I did. I dated a little in New York, but women scared me. They were either too brash and manly or drank too much. People weren't as open then either, so if I was attracted to someone, most of the time I didn't know if she was gay. And I've never been the aggressive one, never the one to make a move or give someone my number. So I worked all hours, and in my free time talked to Penny on the phone and listened to her tell me about the meetings she went to and the sober women she lived with. And I went to see her. This went on for a couple years before that night at the Holiday Inn. I saw those Christmas tree eyes and my life changed. 3 nights? She asked as she looked at my reservation. I don't think I managed more than a nod in response. You happen to be free for a drink or a bite any one of those nights? Just like that, after 2 words and a nod, she asked me out. Kelly has never been shy, and thank God. I nodded again, and the next night she took me to a steakhouse near the harbor. And the night after that she made me cream of asparagus soup and a big salad with pears and walnuts and chunks of avocado. It was the best salad I'd ever had. I know it sounds insane, but the next night I was on a plane to New York drafting my resignation.
I was 28 and had been alone for a long time. I watched people my age at the Lowell pair off and make plans, throw dinner parties and go on vacations together, get engaged. I knew I didn't want to be alone anymore. I moved in with Kelly 2 months later and took a job at the Westin Hotel as the night manager. It was a far fall down the scale from the Lowell, but I didn't care. I was with Kelly and near Penny, who was clean, living in a sober house, and working in ad sales at a local newspaper. For a long while, I was what most people would describe as happy. I didn't feel that low, lonely ache I'd felt in my gut my whole life. Growing up in Worcester, at school in Amherst, and in New York, especially on the weekends after Penny left. For the first time in my life, I was happy. We didn't have a ton of friends. Kelly had her brothers and nephews, and I had Penny. Outside that circle, we liked plenty of people well enough, colleagues and neighbors and acquaintances, but we mainly kept our own company. We never got wrapped up in the gay scene, which was for young people, and we weren't young anymore. We had our small tribe, and that was enough. Kelly and Penny bickered sometimes, like sisters, and every so often a dinner would end abruptly, Penny getting worked up over something Kelly had said, usually political and storming out. But Kelly adored Penny, and was always the first to show up to her house if a pipe burst or if she needed help painting a room. She was always at our house with this girlfriend or that. None of them stuck. Watching movies, cooking meals, bragging about her softball team victories, complaining about work. She didn't have far to go since she lived 2 doors down to the right from the end of our street. Kelly always used to say that if the wind was just right, she could throw a frisbee from our stoop and hit Penny's house. And then, out of the blue, a couple of kids climbed through Penny's window and raped and strangled her to death. She was alone. The girl she was seeing, she always liked them young, was still in college and asleep at her dorm that night. It was late, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and no one heard her screaming. I still have nightmares about what she must have gone through, how terrified she had to have been. For a long time, I didn't speak beyond muttering. Neither did Kelly. We just sort of coexisted in near silence for months. We went to our jobs, came home, went to bed after eating something. The world had changed, and we with it. Penny's family did not come to her funeral. A friend from New York came, and a girl we knew in college, too, the staff at the paper where Penny had become associate publisher, her softball team, her sober friends, and us. I was a mess. So Kelly spoke, and Penny's boss did, too. And then it was over. There are no words precise enough to describe how wide and empty the world is when you lose someone that matters to you as much as Penny did to me. Every effort suddenly seems useless. I made it through the funeral and a few months after. But the mornings got tougher as time went by, and it became more and more difficult to get out of bed. I started calling in sick to work, and eventually just said I was taking a vacation. 1 week turned into 3, and the manager of the hotel called and said we needed to have a talk. Over the phone, without even so much as meeting with him, I told him I quit. Said those 2 short words, hung up the phone, and rolled back into my pillow. He called Kelly at work and told her what had happened before I could. He told her that he understood I was going through a tough time, and that the hotel was happy to give me a leave and help out in any way they could, but he wasn't accepting my resignation. Kelly came straight home, threw a handful of sweaters and socks and toiletries into a bag, picked me up out of the bed, in my sweatpants and t-shirt, and carried me out the front door and into the passenger seat of her CRX. "Change of scene," is all she said as she started driving, as much to herself, I think, as to me. She pulled onto 101 and headed south along the coast. By the time we got to Astoria, just over the Oregon border, the sun was setting over the Pacific. We stayed the night at a little bed and breakfast, but the town was spooky, steep hills stacked impossibly with ramshackle houses, all of it tilting above a ghosty wharf. We left that morning and drove back up 101 to the edge of Grace Harbor. North of Aberdeen along 109, it's all beach. Little houses, a few motels and beach, and above it all the widest sky I'd ever seen. It was May and still chilly, but we pulled over to the side of the road and walked past the dunes to the water. Kelly told me to take my shoes off even though the sand was freezing cold. The wind was wild, and as we walked we leaned into it to keep moving forward. It was the first real effort I'd made in months, leaning in, not allowing myself to be blown back or down. The hard, cold sand beneath my feet felt good, and I remembered I had a body and that it could feel. We walked along the surf's edge for 20 minutes or so, and eventually we saw the Moonstone. From the beach it looked abandoned, but as we got closer we saw a few lights on in the office and a housekeeper dragging a vacuum between rooms. The place was flaking with old paint, and for the most part empty, but I was struck by the way it squatted at the edge of the beach, under that enormous blue sky, and before the vast Pacific. It sat there, ugly and unbudging, the sandy wind whipping along its rusted gutters. I thought of Penny. We stayed that night in room 6, where Jane is now, but long before the good mattress. And then, after a few weeks of convincing Kelly, we sold our house, quit our jobs, and cashed in our 401ks early. During that time we came back to Moclips twice, and haggled with the Hillworths, who'd been trying to unload the place for years, but had a hard time letting go. Eventually, we bought the Moonstone, and the Hillworths' house next door and all the scratched and broken down furniture in both. Kelly and I had worked in hotels our entire adult lives, and now we owned one that needed us as much as we needed it. Kelly's brothers thought we were crazy, but they knew once we'd made up our minds there was no turning back. That was over 4 years ago, and I still think about Penny every day. I talk to her when I walk the beach and I ask her what she would do about this or that. I've asked her about Jane, and if I should worry. And in the roar of the ocean I hear her say, "Keep watch, but let her be." Each time I head back up the beach and come upon the Moonstone, I remember the first time I saw it, and Kelly's face smiling at me in the crazy wind. And later that night, the two of us crawling into bed in that room that sits so close to the sea. After we turned out the lights, I tucked under the blankets and thanked God. For Kelly, for this life, and for Penny, who helped me survive growing up in Worcester, getting through college, and convincing me to move to New York. And into the dark, I thanked Penny directly for being my best friend, for agreeing to go to rehab in Seattle, for getting sober, and for staying out there long enough for me to check in that night at the Holiday Inn. I shivered as I imagined all the possible outcomes if any one thing had happened differently along the way. If my parents had moved us to some other neighborhood in Worcester when I was a kid. If Penny had never met Chloe and never tried heroin. If I'd picked the Econo Lodge or the Days Inn that night in Seattle. If I'd left New York one day before or after. If Kelly's employee hadn't called in sick. If Penny's girlfriend had slept at her house instead of the dorms that night those kids turned up. If Penny had locked her windows. I curled into Kelly and burrowed as deeply as I could into her back. I remember the tissue-thin, pale yellow t-shirt she wore, pressing my face to it and feeling her warm skin on the other side. And I remember thinking this is what it feels like to be home. Here, in the space around and between us. This fabric, this skin, this smell, this woman. For most of that night I was awake, wondering at it all, the pattern that seemed to emerge when I laid out every fluke and chance encounter, puzzling through all the possible signs and meanings. But any trace of a design disintegrated when I remembered the chaos and brutality of the world, the genocide and the natural disasters, all the agony. I never felt so small, so humbled by the vastness of the universe and the fragility of life. I studied the water-stained ceiling in the room and imagined the things it had seen, the people. Who else had huddled here, pressed into someone they loved as if they were the last thing on earth that mattered? Who else prayed that morning would never come, prayed they'd never have to leave this bed and let go? That night, the moon glowed through the curtains of the locked window, its storybook light dancing a path to the horizon, to the other side of the world. Two car doors slammed in the parking lot. One, then a moment later, the other. I listened for footfalls or keys turning in locks, but heard nothing but the crashing surf outside. From the bed I could see stars. At first, only the big ones. Bright and fat and alone, jumping with urgency. And then the rest, tiny and fierce, a billion grains of sand spilling across the night sky, shining like the coast of heaven. Kelly's sleeping body rose and fell with each breath. I curled closer, held tighter. I pressed my nose to her back, and through the thin cotton smelled the motel soap on her skin. Waves collapsed and exploded on the beach, one after the other, again and again. I was home. George. My son Robert got married this year. He and his wife Joy called me from their honeymoon in Big Sur, California, to let me know they'd gone to City Hall in Oakland to say their vows. Do I wish I'd been there? Of course I do. But it's how they wanted to go about things, and it's their business. I was glad for the phone call. Joy is a strong woman, and I think the two of them make sense together. They're not exactly what you'd call an affectionate couple, or terribly expressive, or at least not from what I've seen in the few times I've seen them together. But given what Robert's been through, just making sense is more than adequate. They're both journalists, both busy, both black, both sober, and neither wants children. Robert writes about human rights abuses in government prisons, and Joy is obsessed with the impact of oil pipelines on indigenous lands. She spends a lot of time in Canada. When they talk about what they're working on, they both tend to shout, so when we speak on the phone or see each other, neither of which is often, I try to steer the conversation to safe subjects like the weather and pets. I love Robert, and I know he loves me, but since his mother died over a decade ago, he stayed away from Atlanta, his sisters, and me. For instance, his sisters haven't met Joy yet, and they've been together for over 4 years. They don't make a fuss about it. Robert for them has always been less a brother and more like a cousin, or a young uncle who visits occasionally. Boarding school in Connecticut, 5 months in hospitals, 2 years of rehab and aftercare in Minnesota, and eventually college in Portland kept him away, sometimes even during Christmas. They knew a lot about him. He was so much and so often the subject of dinner table talk in our house. But I don't think they ever really had a chance to know him. Robert was a fussy toddler, easily upset, quick to cry. After kindergarten, he calmed down and became quiet. Smart as hell and skipped the fourth grade, but he never appeared comfortable in his own skin. Didn't make friends easily. He had one friend from the neighborhood, Tim, a chubby redheaded boy whom he played Dungeons and Dragons with and wrote adventure stories for, which Tim would illustrate with complicated pictures of four-armed, sword-wielding soldiers and magic fairies with no eyes. Robert never liked to share with us the little books they made. Kay and I would sneak peeks from time to time when Robert was in the bath just to check what was going on. Mostly the stories and pictures were pure fantasy. Occasionally, you'd see something upsetting that suggested what our old family therapist would call displaced anger. I'm thinking now of the twin monkeys who got their heads snapped off by a flying griffin with an enormous beak. If the visual symbolism wasn't obvious enough, Robert's story described the death of the twin monkeys as necessary for the survival of the human race. That they would eat all time, and without killing them, the world would run out of hours. Impressive on the one hand for a 10-year-old, but especially disturbing since his room was across the hall from his twin sisters, who from their premature birth required lots of developmental and physical therapy, and who ate up a lot of, well, time. Still, as rattled as I remember us being by that particular story, I don't remember talking to Robert about it, at the time, anyway, or discussing with him any of the books he and Tim made. I'm sure we should have. Just as I'm sure we should have done many other things differently. But I think we were grateful he had a friend in Tim, creepy and aloof as he might be. Together they had a sneaky air about them, and they'd spend hours in each other's rooms scribbling away and talking in a kind of code that Kay and I could never crack. Maybe all that sneakiness and escapism should have been a sign of what would happen later with Robert,
But as a parent, you just have no idea what anything means. On some level, everything your kids do and say is in code. I'm sure some parents are expert at translating, but with Robert, we didn't know where to begin. Also, we had a lot of other things to focus on at the time. The girls needed attention, and when they were three, Kay was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. Robert was 10 then, and often left alone to fend for himself. Between the girls and chemo appointments and trying to keep afloat the real estate development business my brother and I owned, there wasn't a lot of time to play basketball or go over homework assignments. The funny thing is that Robert was the one person, the one area of our lives we didn't worry about. He was so tidy and bright, so self-contained and quiet, that I assumed he didn't need me as much as everyone else did. Sure, he had a spooky side, but he never got in any trouble. I was putting out a lot of fires then, and because with him there was no smoke, no flame, no alarms, I wasn't paying attention. Nothing that wasn't on fire got much of my time, which was something he must have understood from an early age. For the most part, I took him for granted. That he would shower and brush his teeth in the morning, get dressed and pour his own bowl of cereal, you'd think I would have been grateful to have a self-sufficient kid. I think for the most part I was. But a few times he drove me crazy. I remember one morning loading the girls into their car seats while Kay sat in the front sobbing from a migraine brought on by the chemo. The girls were fidgeting and whining and making it impossible to buckle their seatbelts. We were late for school, for Kay's doctor's appointment, and at the time my brother was threatening to sell his half of the business if I didn't get in the game, as he put it. At the edge of all of this sat Robert, cross-legged on the front step of the house, scribbling in his black-and-white composition book, writing one of those wild stories with fire-breathing turtles and dusty witches, completely oblivious to what was going on. I remember looking at him and feeling furious that he was exempt from responsibility, untouched by struggle. This is, of course, what you are supposed to want for your children, but in that moment it seemed unfair. What I wanted was to hit him, shake him violently, rattle his calm, and inflict some of what I was experiencing. It sounds insane, but a part of me felt that if I went near him in that moment, I might kill him. That's how angry I was. I couldn't stand it that nothing seemed to register with him. And I could not have been more wrong. We sent Robert to boarding school when he was 15, which was when Kay's cancer came back and had spread to her lymph nodes. This time it was stage 4, and we panicked. The girls were 8 by then, and we reasoned that if Robert could focus on high school away from the chaos, it would be better for him. He had few friends, and Tim had left for Harkness the year before. Robert wanted to go too, but at the time we didn't take the idea seriously. It was expensive, and in the hills of Connecticut, where none of us had ever been. But a year later we felt under siege. We told ourselves it was what he wanted, and on some level by then I think we trusted his instincts about how he should be raised better than our own. So we said yes. What we didn't know was that by that time, Tim had become quite the little drug czar at Harkness. I don't blame Tim, though for a long time I did. I've since learned that addicts are born, not made. So if it wasn't coke and heroin at Harkness, it might have been liquor and pills in Atlanta. Who knows? What I do know is that when I got the phone call from the headmaster at Harkness telling me that Robert had overdosed on drugs and was in a coma at the local hospital, I thought it was a joke. I'd never seen my son smoke a cigarette or even sip a beer. He was a straight-A student and played trumpet in the school marching band. He was a homebody and scarcely made a peep. The headmaster walked me through the prior 24 hours, a hiking trip that Tim and Robert and another student did not return from, a search party, a woman calling the police when she heard voices in her barn, and finding Robert unconscious when they arrived, and the two other boys running away down the backfield. "You need to come right away," the headmaster said, and so I did. After I landed in Hartford, checked into the motel in Wells, and visited Robert at the hospital, I saw clearly that the situation could change at any moment. My sister and mother moved in with Kay and the girls, and we agreed I should stay put until hopefully Robert could be moved, back home or to a rehab somewhere. I was out of my mind. I remember that strange little motel, with a girl's name, the Betsy, with bad art on the walls
and orange Dial soap in the shower and by the sink. Not the little motel-sized soaps, but the big thick ones you buy in a grocery store. Something about that place was makeshift, definitely not a chain motel. It was clean and quiet, and I spent the first 2 weeks coming back at night from the hospital and wondering how on earth I'd ended up in this room with flowers painted on the headboard and my son in a coma on the other side of this white Norman Rockwell, Connecticut town. Not until after Robert came out of the coma and was eventually moved from the ICU to the rehab unit did I see that motel room in daylight. This was when I met Lydia. Dale. There is always one who goes away. This is what Mimi first said when Will sat us down his junior year in high school to tell us he wanted to go to college on the East Coast. His sister went to Reed, which felt like a world away, and his brother went to the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma. Both were within driving distance of Moclips, where we lived and raised our family, one north, one south. It was selfish of us, but we'd hoped Will would do the same. Don't get me wrong. We wanted them to go where they wanted to go. But our kids have been our life for the last 2 decades. We've been a team, and the change is hard. Both Mimi and I are only children and had parents who died young, so our kids are it. Maybe we just got lucky. Our kids were always great, better company even in their teens than most adults we know. Maybe it sounds unhealthy or codependent, but it's true. Will's sister, Prue, took an interest in gardening when she was 9 and inspired all of us to start seeding vegetables and herbs in the winter to plant in the spring. She organized a system of mulching that Mimi and I still follow to the letter today. By the time Prue left for college, every one of us could have showed up on an organic farm anywhere ready to go to work. And Mike, Will's older brother, he's been turning us on to all kinds of new music since he was in the 3rd grade. Through Mike, we started listening to indie singer-songwriters like Ray LaMontagne and Cat Power. Through Mike, we first heard Moby, and then later Phoenix and Daft Punk. He also introduced us to the music of our own generation, which we for the most part missed. Sex Pistols, Kate Bush, Joy Division, Blondie. Lately, he's fixated on 80s metal bands like AC/DC and Def Leppard, and that's where we part ways. And Will, he was more alert to what was happening politically and socially in the world than any of us. From an early age, he was committed to the environment, the homeless. Later, he became obsessed with Rachel Corrie, the activist from Olympia who was killed by an IDF bulldozer while protesting the demolition of Palestinian homes. He followed every beat of that story. After she was killed, the censorship in New York of the play based on her writings, the stonewalling of the U.S. Congress to block an investigation into her death. Will was 14 and writing letters to our congressmen, letters of support to the Corrie family, insisting our whole family attend the rallies and memorials in her honor. He was a committed kid. He marched, he sat in, he sang, he organized, and we joined him. Neither Mimi nor I had ever been terribly political, but with Will he just brought these issues to life. And his sense of urgency and injustice and responsibility was infectious. His brother and sister teased him a little, but before they left for college, and even after, they showed up to nearly everything he asked them to. They were even arrested with Will when they chained themselves to a homeless shelter in Olympia that was scheduled for demolition due to budget cuts and a plan to develop the land where it stood. Mimi and I got the call from Mike, and we dropped everything right away to bail them out. We were not angry with them or disappointed. Just the opposite. The three of them chained to each other in support of something they believed in was evidence to us that as parents we'd done something right. So when Will told us he wanted to go to Amherst College, we were speechless. Tucked away in the hills of Massachusetts, the school might as well have been on Mars as far as we were concerned. Still, Will broke it to us sweetly, and the three of us cried and decided to call his sister and brother together to give them the news. It was the last year we lived in the house in Moclips. When Will left for college, we sold it to a couple who taught at the college in Aberdeen. They were newly married and planning a family, and what better fit could we have found? As teachers ourselves, elementary school, not college, We thought it was a good omen. We had bought the place from a widow who had never had children with her husband. But from what we gathered over the years, they'd been a tight pair.